Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
We maintain the peace through our strength. Weakness only invites aggression.
Trust but verify.
Well, I've said it before and I'll say it again. America's best days are yet to come.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
On this episode of Reaganism, Roger is joined by Mr. Ben C. Sutton, Jr. Ben is an entrepreneur, culture builder, and philanthropist from North Carolina, who is widely credited for inventing the college sports media business as we know it today. He sold his first company, ISP Sports, to IMG College in 2010. He later engineered the sale of IMG in 2014 for $2.4 billion. Ben is currently the chairman of Teal Capital Partners and serves on the boards of Wake Forest University, the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, the White House Historical Association, the National Football Foundation, the PGA Tour First Tee Foundation, and the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee Foundation. Roger and Ben discuss the role sports play in American culture, what Washington can learn from entrepreneurs, and whether or not we'll see college football in 2020. If you enjoy the conversation, make sure to rate us 5 stars wherever you listen to podcasts, and thanks again for listening.
Ben Sutton, welcome to the podcast. We're thrilled to have you here. So much to talk about your background. Most people know you as the person credited for inventing college sports media business. Tell us a little bit about how you got into that line of work and ISP Sports. It really transformed and revolutionized the market.
So it's a long story. I'll try to do it briefly, Roger. It's great to be with you, by the way. I grew up in Eastern North Carolina, very rural area, town of about 1,500 people called Murfreesboro, North Carolina. And I grew up a huge sports fan. But as a youngster, listened to sports radio broadcast in my front yard next to the farm and just loved it. Fell in love with the Baltimore Colts because I could get their broadcast there. And the Boston Red Sox. I have to be the only guy in America with this accent who's a Red Sox fan. And obviously grew up a lifelong Wake Forest Demon Deacons fan. And when I went to college, I ended up working in the athletic department as part of my scholarship work study requirement. And just had a wonderful experience, actually worked almost full time most of my 3 years of law school to put myself through law school for a great mentor of mine who was the athletic director at Wake Forest for 29 or 30 years, Gene Hooks, and stayed at the institution, at the university, and worked there for 7 or 8 years as an assistant associate athletic director. And then in 1992, I just thought there was a better way for schools to package and sell their sponsorship rights and media rights. And there were 4 companies really in the space at that point. They all had 20 to 70 year head starts on us. We started with one school, Wake Forest, my alma mater. We built a great company that was really predicated around packaging university sponsorship sales rights and all of their radio, play-by-play, television, publications. It was 1992, so Al Gore hadn't invented the internet yet. but once the advent of the internet came along, then we had lots of digital rights. I say that with all due deference and tongue in cheek for my great Democratic friends who might be listening today. We built a really wonderful business, had a great team, and spent 18 years doing that on our own, and basically. I've always had this kind of belief that market makers, if you're the market maker, you have the best or the inside track to becoming the market leader. And that is certainly what happened for us. And within 10 years of launching, we were the largest media rights player in the college sports space. And at 18 years, we merged our business into IMG, which gave us a lot of opportunity to do some other things. We had already launched 3 other businesses inside of our ISP Sports platform. And so we rolled into IMG and took basically what was a combined $400 or $500 million company and built it into almost a $1 billion enterprise.
That's amazing. I got to go back to the Wake Forest part because, I mean, law school, work studies, I get how you end up in the athletic department. You had the passion for sports. But when did you kind of piece this together that they were just going about this the wrong way? And they, in that sentence, is the Wake Forest athletic department and other athletic departments. And, you know, did you ever plan on working a law firm and billing in increments of 6 minutes? Or did you always know you're going to be in the business side of sports?
You know, when I was a first year law student, a 1L at Wake Forest, I remember someone asking or telling me, you know, I got a great lawyer joke for you. And it was, you know, what do you call 100 lawyers buried up to their necks in sand on the beach? And I said, what? He said, not enough sand.
As a lawyer, I can laugh at that.
Yeah, that's right. Me too. So, but no, I really saw that there was so much opportunity. And actually, I believe that athletic departments and athletic enterprises on campuses were so much, they needed so much more sophistication in the 1980s and 90s than they had at that point. And so I actually saw a need and an opportunity to move in into that space rather than going and hanging a shingle or going to work for a firm and practicing law. And it's, you know, quite simply one of the two or three seminal inflection points or decision points of my life. And it was the right thing to do. When we looked at the marketplace, I just couldn't believe the way institutions managed their external commercial marketing rights. I looked at the National Football League. You know, those guys, most of those guys were not billionaires when they started their careers. They became billionaires, which enabled them to buy National Football League teams. They're pretty smart. That's a pretty smart group of owners right there. They always have been. Self-made people and families. And so I looked at the way they operated their business and how they basically wouldn't lose control of their core commercial rights enterprise. And then I looked at the institutions like Wake Forest or North Carolina or, you know, Duke University and so many others where I knew folks that were working on those campuses and they had their radio rights in one bucket and their TV rights in another bucket and their digital rights in another. And by the time they were done, they had four or five different rights holders representing that one institution. And as opposed to taking a more sophisticated commercial rights platform to market and giving sponsors what they want, which was they wanted to have kind of vertical access to what the school had to offer them. And so we were, for whatever reason, the first. And I think when you come into a marketplace, we also started, Roger, in a recession in 1992, which was intentional. I felt like our competitors were paralyzed. Of course, you know, having grown up pretty modestly, I really didn't understand the concept of working capital. I'm not sure many people would do what I did and try to self-finance a business because we didn't have investors. And as I said, I had quite modest means myself. But that was also at a time before all of the, you know, banks have always been heavily regulated, but back then they weren't nearly as heavily regulated, A, and B, there was, you know, banks were the partners and friends to small startup entrepreneurs. They've abdicated that responsibility, quite frankly, part of it because of regulation, but part of it is just a cultural phenomenon. Yeah.
They just got so big, right? They're no longer tied locally.
Yeah. And so you know, which of course that's one of the reasons there's been this advent and of 25 or 30 years now where people have invested heavily in the private equity, the business I'm in today. Sure. Who have become the partners to entrepreneurs and innovators. But I just thought that there was a better way. And so when we took it to market, it was met with, you know, it was modest success. I think we added one school a year for the first 6 or 7 years, but then you had proof of concept. And then the next thing you knew, we had 20 schools a couple of years later. And then 4 or 5 years after that, we had 65 or 70 schools.
So there you are. You got ACC, yeah. You know, SEC and beyond. One more follow-up, because it's interesting as you explain your story, you were in an athletic department of a non-for-profit university, yet to do this, you had to leave. I mean, your analogy is the National Football League, the owners you were talking about, they're able to take care of the on-field stuff and the off-field stuff under one roof. But I've heard you say before, to do this in the college realm, you had to create ISP Sports. You couldn't have done this within a non-for-profit university. Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, so, you know, I would just say, I mean, you know, I'm a huge fan of my alma mater, and I believe universities play a critical role in our society, and you know, but they're not known, just as government's not known, you know, for being groundbreaking innovators or entrepreneurs. These are, you know, these are big bureaucracies like government, and frankly, like lots of big companies, and so. I think it would have been very difficult in that environment to kind of create what we did internally. We were doing the best we could internally, but I also knew that if we went out and got a dozen more schools in the same region doing the same thing, that we could take all those schools to market together. So, you know, every individual school was going to get lift just by not having eight competitors in the name of that one school in the marketplace, creating a race to the bottom on pricing. Now all of a sudden you have all the rights combined so that only one entity could go to market and represent, you know, the University of North Carolina or Wake Forest or Clemson, et cetera. But then if you were to be able to put together a regional group of schools, which was really what we did. I mean, our first 17 or 18 schools were basically mid-Atlantic, but New York basically through the South, Southeast. And then in about 1999, 2000, something like that, we began kind of a westward expansion. And by the time I left, I mean, we were, you know, we had in the Power 65, we had at least half of the schools in every one of the five power, what are now called the Power 5 or Autonomy 5 leagues. And, you know, we actually had most of the schools in about three of them. And so we were able to take all those to market and really create regional and national platforms for big Fortune 1000 companies to buy and invest into college sports. By the way, I was just going to say they love college sports, you know, because it's an enduring fandom. I mean, it's, you know, the NFL guys hate when I say this, but it really is the truth. If you live in Charlotte, North Carolina, and you're a football fan, well, you buy season tickets and you're a Panthers fan, right? But if your job transfers you to Chicago, then you become a Bears fan and you're buying season tickets at Soldier Field and going to Bears games. But if you go to Wake Forest or you go to Clemson or you go to Southern Cal, that's a lifelong affinity and association that never goes away.
No matter where you are.
It's so different than pro sports because it's transportable. And you know, and the best demographic, psychographic profile of any sports entertainment consumer in the world, more millennials, more diversity. You know, sometimes those of us that are on the inside of the college sports world in particular, we are almost, I think, blind to some of the strife that exists in the rest of society because we're in what I consider to be the greatest melting pot in America, and that's college sports.
Because let's drill down on that, Ben, because I've heard you speak about this before, both your concerns about college sports and whether or not it's doing enough to maintain the support and interest of millennials and Gen Zs, but also how you've made acquisitions and investments in your own business, you know, Teal, to really understand the mindset of this next generation. It's giving you some pretty interesting insight. I wonder if you'd share that a little bit and why, in your mind, you're kind of optimistic that this melting pot that you just described, that you've experienced and see happens on college campuses and within college sports, is something that will continue.
So I think that all industries go through ebbs and flows. I mean, you know, I'm sure that my friend Larry Culp, when he became CEO of General Electric, you know, I mean, he knew the kind of challenge that was in front of him. General Electric at times has been, you know, the biggest and maybe even most important company in America, but they'd fallen on hard times. And so even the greatest, you know, ebb and flow, they fall and they grow. And he's there making that company into a great company again. And, you know, quite frankly, if you're going to do something like that, you might as well have the smartest guy in America, and he's probably it. You know, I just think that around college sports, there's often around any industry, but I certainly saw it in college sports and professional sports and entertainment, rock and roll, et cetera, that people kind of let their guard down. They take for granted who their fans are. They're sold out every week, or they're almost sold out. And they don't do the job that they needed to do in terms of outreach to a potential next generation of consumers, fans, leaders, et cetera. And I think that certainly around college sports, that was the case. The boomer generation, biggest generation in the history of America. And so students stopped picking up as many tickets, and young alums were buying less tickets. But those were all being consumed by people that were in my generation, because there were so many of us, and there didn't used to be capacity for all of us to be able to go do the things that we wanted to do. Well, as that generation starts to age out, you realize, oh my God, we missed an entire generation of fans. And there are literally millennials who don't leave college like I did as soon as I could scrape together $500 to be a Wake Forest Deacon Club member and another $300 or $400 to buy season tickets. I did. It was my first big purchase after a condo and a car. And it's just not the case anymore. And so one of the first investments we made at Teal, you know, we started this private equity firm that was most of my C-suite that worked with me and helped build the four companies at ISP and then kind of put it on steroids at IMG College, you know, joined me in this exercise. And the first company we bought was a company that basically helped us understand the mindset of millennials and Gen Xers. And so one of the things that we learned early in this pursuit was that they, young folks, care about community and fellowship more than any generation since probably the 1960s love children. I mean, they really, they look, while they will sit on, you know, I know because I've got two of them.
While they're on the device.
While they'll sit on the couch over here on one side of my living room and sit on the other side, the brother and sister will text each other across the room. They also love being together. They love being with their friends. And so they are, you know, they love being together. And so creating environments where they are all together, I think is very, very important. And that's what we've learned. So one of our businesses is very focused on re-engineering the game and event day experience and creating environments where not just young folks, but all folks can kind of come together and be in fellowship and community and really create structures where, you know, you get them to a place, and then as part of that, you build this fandom with the entity with whom we're working. You know, it's really interesting. One of my, I have really enjoyed talking to you about your faith and your faith community as we've gotten to know each other, Roger, and you have that structure, you know, in your community. And it's really something that I think a lot of people just they took for granted for so long. And then some of the structural environments disappear or dissipate, or those traditions are not carried on. And so you've got to go back out there and re-engineer that. And
it's a great point. I mean, Senator Ben Sasse is someone inside government who talks a lot about these structures, and, you know, a lot of I think he thinks about addressing the divisions in this country are not through government, right? But through the institutions within our localities, you know, or you know, the church or the school or those other you know, civil and civic institutions. And that's kind of what you're describing. You got to, you know, in your business to appeal to, you know, whether it's millennials, Gen Zs, or anybody else, you got to create that sense of community. You know, Ben, one of the other pieces that you think about and look at, both from a business side, but also I know you're just passionate about education and civil society, is that, you know, millennials and Gen Z, they are very focused on not only their community and connections, but also equity and fairness. And that's kind of articulated and framed in lots of different ways. When it comes to college sports, it seems to me that, you know, an area that's a kind of clear path for young people getting involved is making sure that college athletes are treated fairly. You got to be involved in this issue, one form or another. Marco Rubio has legislation looking at this issue. I mean, it's not a particularly partisan perspective, but there are a lot of people advocating that with the amount of money in college sports, that there should be something that goes to the student athlete. How do you think about that issue, said, where do you see it going?
Well, it's I think that folks have to understand the totality of the challenge. And I actually, you know, the last thing you want, with all due respect to Senator Rubio and some of his counterparts on both sides of the aisle, the last thing you want is the government in your knickers when it comes to these issues. And so, you know, I think it was Friedman who said that if, you know, the empty quarter is 250,000 square miles of sand, but if the government was in charge, they'd be out of sand in 5 years. Government is really not the solution to fixing really very many of our challenges and issues. College sports is a very decentralized management environment. It's not like you have a commissioner. The president of the NCAA has none of the powers that Roger Goodell has as commissioner of the National Football League. And so I think it's, you know, I think people are awfully hype, oftentimes hypercritical of an organization and a structure that they don't really understand. Now, I think the structure is screwed up, and I think there should be a better structure. And I wish we actually had a commissioner in and around college sports. And, you know, the guy who runs the NCAA is a great friend of mine and a very bright guy, but he's limited by law and constitution of the organization as to what he can do. What I think people have to understand when they start talking about paying players is that first of all, let's just start with this. Would you and I, had we been really great high school football players, and been recruited to go play at a place like Wake Forest, my alma mater, and they told us that we could get a $75,000 or $80,000 a year scholarship as an 18-year-old high school graduate and come out of school owing not one single penny and have experiences to see all parts of the country, particularly if you grew up very modestly as I did, and your entire education was going to be paid for. You were going to get meals. You were going to get medical treatment. You were going to have great coaching around you, great tutoring assistance, academic assistance. You're going to get all these things that go that are far in excess of the $75,000 or $80,000 a year scholarship. Would we have signed up for that deal? And you and I both know the answer is yes. We absolutely would. So I don't buy the idea that getting a college education, having the college experience, is not consideration enough for a music major or a football player who comes to school on a full scholarship and has everything paid for in those 4 or 5 years often, is not appropriate consideration. Now, lots of kids come to school with no money. And football players, as an example, and really any student athlete anymore, because their practice requirements and meeting requirements and so forth are far greater than they were when I was in school. And so they don't have time to go do what
they can't work. Yeah.
Well, right. They can't go get a job. And so I think some modest amount of of compensation to kind of make up for the fact that they can't do what I did. I was a DJ. I worked in the athletic department. I bartended. I waited tables. I had at any point in college, there was never a point where I had less than three jobs. Never.
I'm stuck on you being a DJ, Ben. This is adding new elements here.
I was great. And so we, you know, they don't have an opportunity to do that. So some modest amount of money, I think, is fine. But let's talk about, you know, let's talk about what the severe unintended consequences are that the talking heads and sports media in particular and some of our legislators get hung up on. 10 schools in America make money off of college athletics. Do some of the coaches make outrageous sums of money? Absolutely. But even their outrageous sums of money are not enough that it's going to change paradigmically the overall number of student athlete experiences that an institution can afford. In fact, most schools, even in the Power 65, have to subsidize their athletic departments through a combination of student fees or just direct subsidies each year to maintain the sports minimums required by the NCAA. Wake Forest is no different. And I would venture to say that out of 15 schools in the Atlantic Coast Conference, at least 13 and maybe 14 have some type of subsidy from the university to help finance their athletic program. So if all of a sudden you decide that you're going to pay football players and basketball players, men's basketball players, a whole bunch of money, I'm not sure how that's going to stand up in a place where Title IX, I mean, the lab for Title IX over the last 30 years has been college athletic departments. Let's call it what it is. Okay. Yeah. So now all of a sudden, are you going to pay the field hockey players? Are you going to pay the tennis players? Are you going to pay the soccer players or the golfers?
Right.
And here's the unintended consequence that really, I mean, this is going to happen if they say, well, it's just every man for himself and start paying players and these are just semi-pro leagues. You're going to have institutions that have 16 sports teams that are going to downsize to 8. You're going to have institutions that have 25 that downsize to 12 because they're not going to be able to afford to field 25 sports and fund scholarships for 800 kids. And that is, I mean, everybody who takes the position the football players and basketball players, they ought to be able to, you know, like, I'm sorry, but the proposal, I understand what, you know, the Pac-12 players put out a week ago, and you got a bunch of people chirping in your ear and telling you what you ought to be asking for and so forth. But what they don't understand is they're going to put soccer out of business. They're going to put swimming out of business. They're going to put tennis out of business. And so my view is if they're going to be institutions that want to win at all costs and are willing to pay players, it, you know, honestly, if there are 20 or 25 of those that want to be a feeder league for the National Football League, then so be it.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, work. Yeah. So, I mean, what I hear you saying is that if we're going to focus on equity for a guy like Zion Williamson, right, who is obviously bringing in a huge amount of revenue for college sports generally, you know, in this case, Duke, you solve that problem, you create a lot of other problems in terms of the rest of college sports.
Nobody ever talks about all the other unintended consequences, and there's a right holistic strategic way to go about it. Here's one other unintended consequence. Last year, I think USA Today published an article and said, had name, image, and likeness been in play last year, then the point guard at North Carolina would have made something like $450,000 on his name, image, and likeness. And by the way, companies that invest in college sports through sponsorship, they have finite pies for their marketing budgets. That $450,000 that went to him was almost by definition, therefore, not going to go to the institution.
Right.
One. Two, what was that locker room going to be like? He's making $450,000 But his 11 teammates are in the locker room with him, and they're making zilch, or making $1,500 over here and $2,300 over there. What do you think that locker room is going to be like? College was never intended to be a feeder league for the NFL or the NBA. And so I'm actually one of those people. There are some people around the college sports business that kind of hated seeing the G League come along. I think it's great.
Because that pressure away. Yeah, it's a place to go.
I'm a wild-eyed American capitalist. I'm a free enterprise guy, right? And so if a kid comes out of college, I mean, you're old enough maybe to remember. I'm certainly old enough to remember when Moses Malone and Daryl Dawkins went straight from high school and into the pros. Sure. And I think that's great. That's the American way. And so go straight to the pros. And so I like that. And I pull for these, you know, like I'm hoping that the guys that just bought the XFL can, you know, Vince wasn't able to make it go, but I hope the next guys can. And because I want a place for an 18-year-old kid that doesn't care about a college education to go play and ply his craft.
So go back to XFL. You think Dwayne The Rock Johnson made a good investment there?
Well, I mean, you know, I think they paid $15 million for it. So, you know, I still think there's room for an organization. I thought that one would make it, to be honest with you, because I think personally, I find Oliver Luck to be one of the brightest guys I've ever known in or around sports, period. Okay. And so I thought if there was ever a professional sports league, that would make a go of it, it would be that league because he is so bright. And I thought Vince was committed to it. And for whatever reason, I mean, part of it was the pandemic, I'm sure, and other things. Maybe things just didn't go the way they were supposed to. But it is a startup, and it's not going to be easy, and it's going to be really hard work. But I do think that there's still room for kind of a mid-tier between college and National NFL. Football League tier.
Let's shift gears here, Ben. I mean, this has been a fascinating conversation, and your passion and your depth of understanding about sports generally, and of course, college sports, makes it just super interesting. A lot of our listeners on the Reaganism podcast are going to be kind of scratching their head saying, did I accidentally go on the sports podcast? Why am I on the Reaganism podcast? So, you know, another part of your life and one that I've gotten to know over the past few years is your passion for politics, your passion for President Reagan and the values and principles that he advanced. And really underlying that is just a passion for this country and your patriotism. You know, full disclosure, you're a trustee of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation Institute. And so the Reagan Institute falls under the foundation. Give us a little background as to how you, this entrepreneur, this wild-eyed capitalist, entered and linked up with the world of politics, conservative politics, and President Reagan.
So it's an interesting story, and as you know, I mean there are all kinds of little intertwines in there too. As you know, President Reagan was a former Iowa Hawkeye play-by-play announcer at WOC in Des Moines, Iowa. Years ago, the chairman of our board, Fred Ryan, and I met, and he was running a company called All Britain Communications, a very fine television operator, their own stations around the country. And as the sports world was being kind of rolled up, these networks for these individual institutions being rolled up, Fred and I met, and I actually bought a company from him. And we became fast friends. And but he's just, we're great friends, and he's one of the most decent, honorable people I know. And then we found, we crossed paths one time in London, and we found that we had another mutual friend, Jerry Parenchio. Jerry, I think at that time, was chairman of Univision and was also on the board of the Reagan Foundation. And Jerry and I were on the board at IMG together. And so Fred started talking to me about potentially becoming a board member. And I would tell you, it's been literally one of the great privileges of my life. I mean, I'm I'm so fortunate, Roger. I served some incredible institutions, the Olympic Committee and Wake Forest and Reagan Foundation, the National Football Foundation, the White House Historical Association. But it is the preeminent honor of my life to work on this foundation and to have gotten to know Nancy Reagan in the last years of her life. And so it's just been, you know, it's just been a real privilege for me and for my family to participate in what we're doing in the foundation. I remember one of my first meetings, board meetings, I walked in first. The first thing I told Fred, I sent him a text in the meeting. I said, why am I here? I looked around and it was like, you know, it's like America's All-Stars. And I was sitting right next to my great friend, Governor and Senator Pete Wilson. And, you know, just almost in awe of the group that was so dedicated and committed to what we were doing. But in our very first meeting, I talked about, you know, my study of other presidential libraries and how they often, you know, they kind of become dinosaurish, you know, and I think you and John and the staff there have done an unbelievable job to keep our library vibrant and full of people. And so, and I think that's great. I think we have a great plan there, but I also love the idea. And I remember Mrs. Reagan so well talking in one of our board meetings about perpetuating, you know, ideals of freedom and, you know, and strength and courage and governance. I mean, that's one of the things that people forget about our, you know, President Reagan. President Reagan he understood the concept of governance. And he and Tip O'Neill, other than their Irish heritage, could not have been more different. And yet they were able to sit in the White House and cobble together deals that required both sides to compromise. And that is the essence of governance in America. And so they came at things very differently. But they were able to get, they kept the country moving. And, you know, quite frankly, we haven't had that level of cohesion and the world working together politically in our country, you know, since that time. And so she cared greatly about perpetuating that notion. And so the board took her at her word on her challenge to build this institute in DC, which has been, I think, one of the, greatest projects with which I've ever personally been affiliated or associated with. And so I've been proud to help raise some money for it, give money to it, work at your side to make this into something that I think will be one of, I think we'll look back in 10 or 20 years and we'll say this was one of the most important things we did to honor the legacy of President Reagan, but more importantly, because he wouldn't, you know, he just didn't have ego. And so more importantly, to perpetuate these ideals of working together and bringing America together to make great things happen.
I mean, your support, Ben, and all the focus, not just in terms of the Sutton Family Auditorium at the Reagan Institute, but the programmatic piece and your involvement, whether it be the Reagan Institute Summit Education and our leadership in the American Presidency programs, really reinforced the need to make the foundation focus not just on the past, but as you've been emphasizing, the future. You know, I want to read you a quote you recently said in another podcast, perhaps our competition, because it does reflect, less optimism about those in office today. And I kind of wonder, to get your take on where we are in this country politically and what we have to do to kind of get back to the optimistic forward-looking outlook that we saw with the President Reagan. But you had said something that there aren't 50 members of Congress today who could have gotten a job at ISP, you know, the first company that you started, which you spoke about at the beginning of this discussion. You know, what are you seeing out there? You're quite active in the world of politics. You're really engaging with politicians and elected officials at the federal, and I suspect also the state and local level too. What's wrong?
So I did say that, and I stick by that, by the way. Government and being particularly elected positions in government were meant to be a way to give back to society. And if you look at the founders and the legislatures that were the Congress as it were for a long time, you would have folks that worked and plied a craft for some period of their life, and then they felt like they, in service to their country, they should run for public office and go back and serve their country. And you know, my view is, Roger, that if a person on Capitol Hill, if the best job they've ever had is being in the Senate or being in the House of Representatives, then they're in the wrong job. Hmm. I mean, I really believe that. I mean, I literally, you know, I would love to see a movement in our country to work towards a constitutional amendment for term limits. Because I think it's, you know, the folks get in Washington, D.C., and this is not true of all of them. Look, I have some wonderful friends in Washington, and I count Susan Collins and Rob Portman and, you know, Tom Tillis and Ben Sasse. You mentioned Ben Sasse a moment ago. Ben Sasse is maybe the most brilliant human being that I've ever met in government or politics in my career. And I've known hundreds of congressmen and senators, several presidents. I mean, he is brilliant. We need more people like him in Washington. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter which side of this political spectrum you are. I just want people who bring fresh ideas, who are willing to create disruption and innovate and get together and govern. And Ben is certainly emblematic of that. And you know, I think Senator Collins is. And I mean, I have friends on both sides of the aisle, by the way. But I really believe that it's become I'm trying to remember, maybe it was Carly Fiorina in the presidential, I think, created the term, the political class. Mm-hmm. That it's really what has happened. And I just don't think it is a good thing when people go to Washington, D.C., and it becomes their lifelong vocation. And it's not good for America. And so, because you don't get fresh ideas, you have people who are inside that bubble, they get very stale, and their whole world is clouded by a worldview that really doesn't go outside of the district.
They become kind of victims of the Beltway.
They really do. And when you parachute into town, you know, 8 or 10 or 12 times a year, like I do, you realize, really, you know, frankly, how insular and incestuous it is. It really is. It's really, really bad, and it's not the real world. It's just not the real world. I would love to see more churn in our legislature and in our process, and where we got back to a fundamental premise that the founders intended, which was this would be a kind of a temporary moment of service to your country, not something that you would go up there and you would run for 6 terms as United States Senator.
Right.
And then if you're a Republican,
one quick follow-up on that.
Yeah.
This is kind of coming from someone who's, you know, my background, having the opportunity to work in the Congress as a staff person. You know, you definitely need some time to figure out the institution, right? So, you know, if you were going to get the Sutton constitutional amendment that was just announced here today, breaking news here on the Reaganism podcast, I mean, you need some people to kind of figure out the lay of the land before they're exiting, because the institution itself, I don't think would do well if everybody's coming in and kind of seeing it for the first time. I mean, the analogy of the business world, you kind of need people with experience before they could, you know, before you trust them to take on one of your businesses, right?
I think to some degree, but I also think, Roger, that you know, I'm a lot of people don't like the word consultant or don't like consultants, but The way I say it is, I think there are lots of subject matter experts on a lot of different issues. If I ran for Congress or the Senate and won, you know, I would not go in front of my constituents and act like I was a subject matter expert on matters of defense. I would hire you and say, come
and
in
and put you out of office right away.
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, my chief financial officer will tell you, he doesn't even let me on his side of the building. I mean, everybody has their strengths and everybody has their weaknesses. I do think there are institutional intricacies that have to be worked through. And I wish we could do it in a way where you didn't need something that was so dramatic as term limits. But we've created a culture over the last 100 years of people literally going to Washington and being there and staying there forever and really never having ever accomplished anything else in their life. And I just don't see being a United States Senator or a representative as what ought to be the seminal moment in a person's life. It ought to be part of the larger package. But 6-term and 7-term senators and 22-term representatives is not healthy for the United States of America.
All right. Well argued there. We got a couple minutes left in this discussion. We're going to get to the lightning round, the Reagan lightning round. But before we do, need to get your quick predictions on this intersection between college sports and, of course, the global pandemic, COVID-19. We're all enjoying watching the NBA right now, the bubble, the WNBA, watching that with my daughters. That's great. The Wubble, I believe they call it.
The Wubble. I love it.
The Wubble. We got NHL going on. Major League Baseball has been tripped up a little bit, but it continues to push through. And the next big thing is college football, Ben. Are we going to see college football in the fall? And if the answer is yes, which conferences can we expect to watch?
So, you know, I hate to – I might sound like somebody that's on one of the Sunday morning shows. You know, no politician's ever given a straight answer on the Sunday morning shows. I mean, I watch every week and I'm like, but he didn't answer the question. I've been having the same frustration for 55 years. But
they probably hired a consultant to tell them how to do that.
You know, I've gone back and forth on this, but I think that the Big 12, the Atlantic Coast Conference, and the Southeastern Conference right now, I think they really believe they're going to play. And I want to believe that they're going to play. And Roger, if they play, I think it's good for America. If you look historic, I'm a big student of history. And history does nothing if not repeat itself. And if you look, I mean, you can go back, whether it's 9/11 or recessions, the Depression, World War II, World War I, seminal moments that occurred that united the country and brought the country together. You know, the first and best path out of the negativity was almost always sports. And so I think, you know, the kids want to play, their coaches want to coach. I think in their heart of hearts, most college presidents want them to play. And I'm not sure that, again, because of the decentralized decision-making structure of college sports, you can have these leagues bailing out and some leagues staying in. But I think it would be good for the country if they did play. I think America needs to get back to business. I don't understand the folks out there that, you know, who have tried to politicize things like wearing a mask and social distancing. I'm for going back to business, getting back to business, but I'm also for using common sense measures that most medical professionals believe are advantageous as we do that. I think they can do the same thing in college.
So they can find a healthy or a safe way to do this.
Yeah. I mean, think about a lot of the kids, and not just in football, but student athletes in general. So many of these kids are, you know, this was their way out of wherever they were. And they're in a place where they get they're fed healthy meals, they're in school, they're earning, making progress towards a degree, they've got great medical care. If they go back to where they were when they're not on that campus, oftentimes they would be in what we would all categorize as at risk. And so I actually think they're safer in these bubbles. Do I think every student or every student athlete is going to adhere to all the rules and the protocols? No, I do not. I mean, they're 20-year-old kids. I know how I was. And so, but I really think there's going to be a concerted effort here. Whether they can play a full season, I don't know, but I'd love to hope so. I would love to hope so. And I've admired watching my friend Adam Silver and my friend Jay Monahan as an example. I think they have been at the NBA and at the PGA. These are two of the most brilliant guys in sport. Okay. These guys could run Fortune 500 companies if that's what they wanted to do. They are really brilliant guys. They've got lots of people working around their sport and their players. And I think they've taken really measured and positive and good responses. They've done their very best. And so I think you're going to see some of the same stuff in college. And I hope it happens. I really do.
All right. We heard it here. Let's go to our lightning round. We do this every podcast. We ask our guests to share with us their favorite book, speech, or quote by President Reagan. So take all three, two, or just one of those. Book, speech, or quote.
Book, you know, it's strange. Probably hardly anybody would pick this as the book, but Speaking My Mind. And one of the reasons is because I love listening to Mrs. Reagan talk about how President Reagan would get his speeches from Peggy Noonan and others, and they would help him craft these speeches. And then he would go in and just start scratching stuff out and writing in the margin. And I've seen, you know, the note cards and the scripts where he just went and he's like, I don't like this. I'm going to put it in my words. This is the way I want to say it. Kind of like Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Exactly.
And so I love that book, which I think the first speech in it was like from the 1950 or 51 Kiwanis National Convention. And then the last one is his farewell speech in 1989. And so I just really, I love that book because I think it gives you the essence of that man over four decades as he built his political career. My favorite speech, Boys of Pointe du Hoc, the first draft of the speech written by my friend Peggy Noonan, who also serves on the board. And, you know, I mean, like, I could just listen. I mean, Peggy, even when she talks, it's like listening to poetry, right? I mean, so it's just, I just think it's one of the greatest speeches ever. And honestly, my favorite quote is from that speech. And I just spoke to the graduating rookie class of the Winston-Salem, North Carolina Police Department a few weeks ago. And bought lunch for all the sworn officers. Do I think that there are things in police departments around the country that can be fixed? Absolutely. Basically in every institution of America, in America, there are things that need to be fixed, but I love the men and women in blue. And I shared this with them, but strengthened by their courage, heartened by their valor, and borne by their memory, let us continue to stand for the ideas for which they lived and died. And I just salute all of our men and women in uniform around the country. It's because of them that we get to live, as I have, the American dream.
Well, we'll leave it there, Ben Sutton. Eloquent, thoughtful. Thank you so much for your time today. It was great to have you on the podcast, and we look forward to having you back in the not-too-distant future.
Great. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you.